to Psy.
Spend the day with Psy.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma, presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Today, we present Professor's ninth talk in the current series. Over to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sai Ram and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. This is my ninth talk in the current Dharma series. And as announced in my last talk, I am staying with chapter 3 of the book of Gurcharan Das that is providing the motivation for this Dharma series. Just to remind you, the title of this particular chapter, namely chapter 3, is Yudhishthira's Duty. The last talk centered largely around various doubts that Draupadi had regarding Dharma. Being a righteous woman, Draupadi believed that adherence to Dharma must be rewarded with a good life. Instead, there the Pandavas were, stuck in the forest and leading an austere life, while their kingdom had been snatched by their crooked Kaurava cousins, headed by the wicked Duryodhana, and actively supported by their father Dhritarashtra, who was not only physically blind, but also blind to moral values. Yudhishthira's response that his actions were driven by an intrinsic sense of duty made little sense to Draupadi, and her frustration is fully understandable. In today's talk, I intend to follow Das while he seeks an answer to the question, where does our sense of duty come from? The characters of the Mahabharata offer varying views, all of which I briefly discussed in my previous talk. Today, I would like to track Das as he explores the views of Western philosophers. After making a passing mention of Thomas Aquinas, Das refers mainly to David Hume, Immanuel Kant, and John Locke. Let me begin by quoting what Das says. Quote, "Where does our sense of duty come from? David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, argued that our moral sense originated from human sentiments. The sentiments dependent on humanity are the origin of morals," Hume said. Kant also felt that one's sense of duty originates in one's humanity. But Kant added that the noble descent of duty lies in the rationality of the natural being. Kant located the origin of Dharma in man's ability to reason, and the ability to reason underpins man's autonomy. This condition, Kant wrote, requires that a person never be used as a means when it is an end in itself. Whereas Kant justified duty based on man's humanity and reason, earlier Western thinkers had appealed to natural law. They claimed that human beings have inside their nature a law or a guide as to what is right and what is wrong. Christian thinkers like Thomas Aquinas offered a brilliant exposition of natural law in the Middle Ages. Later, John Locke provided an influential variant of this idea based on natural rights. He argued that human beings had certain rights when they started out in a state of nature, and these rights continued even when that state of nature was over and they became citizens of civil society. End of quote. Well, the quote I just offered may not be all that clear, but don't worry, for soon I shall explain what it all means. Meanwhile, let me continue with Das, who says, and I quote again, David Hume also felt that the rules of a society were a social creation. While at the individual's level, moral rules may well be inviolate injunctions that a person must follow unquestionably, at society's level, they are justified by social utility. This justification of morality is sometimes called indirect utilitarianism. Its attraction lies in its ability to combine both the approaches, one that judges the goodness of an act by looking at its consequences and the other of looking at the intentions behind the act. End of quote. You may recall me saying in my opening talk that as a graduate, Gurcharan Das studied philosophy in Harvard, and upon returning to India, he went to work in the corporate sector. Given his early background, it is no surprise that Das is very comfortable with philosophers. Most of us, on the other hand, have little familiarity with philosophy, be it Eastern or Western. That is certainly true of me. I therefore believe it is appropriate to begin with some explanatory notes so that we can follow better the arguments that Das makes. This would come up after a quick tutorial on the four Western philosophers Das refers to, namely Thomas Aquinas, John Locke, David Hume, and Immanuel Kant, in particular about their views on morals and duty. Okay, with that preamble, let me start with Thomas Aquinas, who lived between 2025 and 2074. He was an Italian Catholic priest who later became a great theologian and scholar. Aquinas starts with God, who of course is perfect. Humans become aware of truth, said Aquinas, via revelations by God. That being said, humans could also acquire knowledge by using their senses to observe what is around them. Being a priest, virtues are very important to Aquinas, and he defined what he referred to as four cardinal virtues, they being prudence, temperance, justice, and fortitude. The cardinal virtues are natural, stand revealed in nature, and are binding on everyone. While discussing cardinal virtues, Aquinas does not make any explicit connection between virtue and God. As if to make up for this, Aquinas then extends his list of virtues by adding three theological virtues, namely faith, hope, and charity. Now, why on earth did Aquinas make this addition? Here is the answer. Anyone can be virtuous. Christians, however, Aquinas argued, were required to make sure that their actions had a charity component, since charity is a theological virtue. Now, here is an example. Most of us would agree that courage is a virtue. That being said, according to Aquinas, a Christian must combine courage with charity. Non-violent movements provide a good example. It takes a lot of courage to stage a non-violent protest. However, not infrequently, non-violent protesters turn violent when attacked by, say, law enforcement. Where Christians are concerned, Aquinas demanded that courage must be blended with charity. In practice, that meant that not only should the protesters respond to violence with peace, but also charity. That means protesters should forgive their attackers and show love to them instead of anger. This might seem like a tall order, but if you recall, that exactly is what Mahatma Gandhi did, combining the courage to take on the mighty British Empire with ahimsa. Aquinas also distinguished four kinds of laws, namely eternal law, natural law, human law, and divine law. Eternal law, said Aquinas, is ordained by God, applies to all of creation, and is unchangeable. That is why the law is said to be eternal. Eternal law exists whether humans exist or not. Natural law, on the other hand, is that which humans are able to deduce by use of their reasoning power. When, based on natural laws, a codified set of laws is derived that can be used as the law of the state, one has what are called human laws. In other words, human laws basically refer to civil and criminal laws that societies establish via some kind of a formal process. Way back in the 13th century, ordinary people in England rose against the ruler to establish the foundation of what subsequently became civil law. This leaves divine law, which Aquinas defined as that which is stated in the scriptures, that is to say the Bible. For example, the Bible says, "Thou shalt not kill." According to Aquinas, this would be a divine law. Okay, we turn next to the English philosopher John Locke, who lived between 1632 and 1704. His starting point was that we are all born without innate ideas and that knowledge is acquired by the individual solely via experience derived from sense perception. Locke then said that shaped thus by experience, it was natural for humans to be selfish. Note that. Now, in turn, this led Locke to become a strong advocate of individual rights. At the same time, Locke said that the claim to rights must be bounded by reason and tolerance. Locke's theory of rights had a great influence in shaping the American Declaration of Independence. At the same time, Locke was very Christian in his outlook and held the view that we are God's property and have been sent by God into the world to do His work. It seems to me that Locke was all for God while at the same time believing that it was natural for humans to be selfish, but within the bounds of reason and tolerance. All in all, Locke's philosophy seemed to call for a delicate balancing act. It is natural to wonder why I brought in Locke, since he appears to say little about morals and values. Well, Locke comes into the picture via the importance he attached to rights, and since these days it is rights rather than duty that dominates public thinking, it is useful to have some idea of how it all started. Now, nature has endowed the planet with a massive reservoir of all sorts of raw materials, which remained unused till humans appeared on the scene. It was humans who could, using God-given skills, create things of value to society, drawing upon the abundance of raw materials kept ready by God long before they, i.e. the humans, made their appearance. Consider, for example, a bridge. Now, a river is certainly useful to humans in many ways, but when it comes to crossing the river, one cannot obviously always wade across a river. Of course, one could cross a river using a boat, but a good and wide bridge facilitates a non-stop two-way traffic, which is far superior to using boats. Bridges are therefore necessary, and human effort alone can create bridges. Thus it is that roads and bridges are of considerable value to society and are referred to as part of the basic infrastructure. The point being made is that bridges, roads, airports, bus services, train services, and so on, all these come explicitly out of human labor, and every one of them add value to society. Now, keeping all this in view, let us consider a house that a man has built. The house obviously has value because human effort has gone into building the house. Humans have been building houses long before Locke appeared on the scene. But Locke it was who explicitly noted that it is human labor that creates value, a concept that Marx would embrace later while developing his philosophy of communism. Locke also declared that anything of value that a person creates or acquires is a property to which that person has a right. Locke obviously did not invent the idea of property ownership. All he did was to formally state as a philosophical principle the idea that a person who produced something of value had the right to own that thing that he made or possessed, which certainly is what happens all the time with houses. Locke went further and made the important statement that since humans began creating property long before governments or civil society appeared, government cannot dispose of the estates of the subjects arbitrarily. This, by the way, is Karl Marx's parted company with John Locke. John Locke's idea of rights has since expanded not only to what is called human rights, but also in terms of political philosophy, particularly in America, where property rights is a sensitive issue and is aggressively defended in the so-called red states, that is to say, states where agriculture dominates. Even more important is that presently the clamor for rights has so possessed the market that it is literally turning society upside down. I do not have the time to go into all that now, and anyway, our present interest is in trying to understand how Western philosophers try to give shape to the concepts of morals and morality. Having said that, I must digress briefly to say that I was completely taken aback by some recent events, which centered largely on what is being described as the right to offend or be offensive. I can't just understand this. What's going on? Has civility lost its place in civil society? I suppose when humans lose their basic humanness, anything can happen, including regular football match rights. I'm sure you know what I'm referring to. We move on now to David Hume, who lived between 1711 and 1776. Hume was a Scottish philosopher who held that human behavior is governed largely by desire than by reason, as Descartes, who came earlier, had concluded. Hume believed in moral principles, but did not accept the idea that morals need to be anchored in God. Instead, Hume was one of the first to argue that one could be secular and still be committed to moral principles. At the same time, actions must also be performed with an eye to the consequences or the outcome of actions, which must always be pleasing and useful. Hume's approach appeals to Das, who says that the attraction of Hume's approach lies in its ability to combine both the approaches, one that judges the goodness of an act by looking at its consequences and the other of looking at the intentions behind the act. The last in our list of Western thinkers is the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who lived between 1724 and 1804. Kant is widely regarded as one of the most influential figures in modern philosophy. His main point was that reason is the source of morality. By so saying, Kant placed himself between two then existing schools of philosophical thought. On the one hand, there were the empiricists, who saw knowledge as evolving from experience. If you recall, Aquinas belonged to this group, and he went further on this road to infer his version of moral rules. On the other hand, there were the rationalists like Descartes, who lived between 1596 and 1650, Spinoza, who lived in between 1632 and 1677, and Leibniz, who lived between 1646 and 1716, all of whom believed that one can construct the world a priori through the sheer power of logic and reasoning. The important point to note here is that experience does not play any role in this process of reconstructing the world a priori. In other words, the world so constructed is objective and not subjective. The rationalists, as one writer put it, hope to escape the epistemological confines of the mind by constructing knowledge of the external world, the self, the soul, God, ethics, and science out of the simplest indubitable ideas possessed innately by the mind. Kant began by recognizing the critical role played by the senses on the one hand and the mind on the other. Whereas the empiricists tended to depend heavily on what the senses told them, the rationalists went to the other extreme to depend purely on the power of reasoning of the mind. Kant argued that the mind does enter the reasoning process and therefore cannot stand apart from the senses, since the mind is connected to the senses. More explicitly, the mind gets constantly shaped by experiences of the past, and this conditioning influences what the mind thinks and experiences later. Let me give a simple example. Supposing one enters a crowded train with a wallet in the back pocket. That's obviously a risky thing to do, and yet many do it all the time. Okay, there is a person who keeps doing this, but sure enough, one day or the other, that fellow's pocket will get picked and the wallet would disappear. The next time after that experience, when the person goes out, he would be quite careful, that is for sure. What this trivial example shows us is past experience conditions future thinking and behavior. Where the brain is concerned, I'm sure you know it has a lot of folds. These folds are supposed to come due to accumulated experience. All this is fine, but what has it got to do with morals? Well, it turns out that one of the questions that Kant posed to himself was, what makes an action moral? While trying to figure out an answer to that question, Kant considered two factors that could influence the action one takes, one being the consequences of the action and the other being the motivation for the action. Kant came to the conclusion that the moral worth of the action is determined not by the consequences but by the motivation. Kant did not stop there. He went further to spell out what the motivation ought to be. Kant said that the motivation must be such that it emerges from certain universal principles that can be discovered by reason. Clearly, this might sound like buck passing, and to avoid the charge, Kant said, act only according to that maxim by which you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. In simple words, what this means is that one must make sure that the motivation one selects itself gets accepted later as a moral law. This might sound like circular reasoning, but I can give two examples that would illustrate that Kant was not far off the mark. My first example comes from electronic engineering and goes back many years to the time when software was its infancy, while hardware was ruling the roost. There were many companies like Hewlett-Packard, IBM and so on during those days that dominated the control system market. Each company had its own internal standards for almost everything from printed circuit boards to making electronic bins of various sizes and so on. These were all internal standards and each company had its own. In due course, when people began to buy different pieces of equipment from different vendors, they faced lots of problems in connecting equipment made by one manufacturer to that of another. To eliminate such problems, professional organizations stepped in and laid down common standards. Where the world of electronic engineering is concerned, the standards laid down by the Institution of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, or IEEE as it is known, are world famous. What Kant is essentially saying is, make your actions so perfect that one day they become the standard. Thus, where truth is concerned, the story of King Harishchandra is something like a gold standard. I'm sure many of you are aware of the tremendous impact this particular story had on Gandhiji when he was young. Returning to Kant, by way of stressing his preference, he said, when moral worth is at issue, what counts is not actions which one sees, but those inner principles for actions that one does not see. A hint at Dharma and nothing more. That's all we get from Kant. Okay, so much for a brief recap of Western thoughts regarding morals and morality. And it is time to get back to the issue, where does our sense of duty come from? While all of us intuitively understand what duty means, it is nevertheless useful to start by finding out what people have said about this important word duty. Such a discussion is needed because Lord Nelson famously declared, England expects every man to do his duty. However, Lord Nelson did not say what exactly he expected of his countrymen. Perhaps he thought they all knew what exactly their duty was. People sometimes say, it is my moral duty or moral obligation to do such and such a thing. In this case, duty gets explicitly tied to morality. Is this always the case? And what if it is not? Keeping such nuances in mind, let us first look at the dictionary meaning of the word duty. Apparently, the word duty is derived from the word due, which refers to something that is owed by, say, A to B. The word duty is also connected to the Latin word debitum, meaning debt, which implies that what is owed or due is a moral commitment or obligation by someone to some other person or something. In his work on duty, the Roman philosopher Cicero said that duty is a concept unique to humans. Duty depends on one's situation in life and the circumstances one is placed in, while the manner in which duty is performed depends on the nature and the character of the individual, as also what the individual perceives that duty to be. Indeed, the perception of duty tends to vary from culture to culture, and also how the community in which the individual lives has been shaped. Furthermore, duty is not only about doing things right, but also about doing the right thing. It is interesting to note that duty is not always glorified, and has in fact been criticized by the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who lived between 1844 and 1900. According to Nietzsche, duty is a chain that binds people, preventing them from thinking, yielding to deep personal desire and inner compulsion, and in the process denying joy to the individual. Nietzsche's view was that if life just became a matter of routinely following one's duty, it would reduce humans to machines. Obviously, I am not prepared to dismiss duty the way Nietzsche does. All of us in Sai circles have heard the familiar sayings, duty without love is deplorable, while love with duty is desirable. Having said that, actions performed purely out of love without any compulsion of duty is truly divine. That is understandable, and indeed Swami was a testimony to that. As Krishna explained to Arjuna, avatars have no duty whatsoever. However, they are always busy in action, which they engage in by way of setting an example to us humans. Furthermore, the actions of the avatars are always saturated with the fragrance of pure love. Sorry about that diversion to discuss duty, but then, are we not discussing the question, where does our sense of duty come from? Let us now focus on seeking the answer, remembering that Das also is on the same track. We begin with the fact that duty always involves action. However, people often do not realize that action need not always involve dynamic, energetic, physical action. And in the Vedantic spirit, we shall take action to include thought, speech, and in addition, deed. Even the latter could be very simple, like smiling, for example. Okay, so duty is connected to action. But does that say it all? Obviously not. And many questions remain, including two important ones relating respectively to A, motivation for the action, and B, consequences of action. We have seen that where the characters of the Mahabharata are concerned, they all had their own opinions about duty. By declaring that I act because I must, Yudhishthira was essentially telling us that duty is a non-negotiable action. Why did Yudhishthira believe that to be so? That he does not clarify. Vidura, you may recall, felt that before performing any action in the name of duty, one must first carefully examine the consequences that the proposed action might produce. Duryodhana took a highly twisted view of duty by declaring that as a king it was his legitimate duty to ensure that he was more powerful than other kings. One thing absolutely certain is that all characters of the Mahabharata believed A, in God, B, that duty was an aspect of Dharma, and C, that duty was connected with the divine. That being said, few at that time had little clue about the exact connection between moral values and morality on the one hand and God on the other. Turning next to the Western philosophers, we saw that the views of Thomas Aquinas are not far off from what I have said above, particularly his stress on theological virtues. Then we have Hume, who wanted morality achieved via a delicate balance between the motivation for action and the consequences of action, without bringing in God. No wonder Hume holds great appeal to Das, Gurcharan Das, who is on the lookout for a similar formula, but within the framework of the Mahabharata. As for Kant, he wanted action stroke duty to be anchored in motivation rather than consequences. Furthermore, Kant clearly wanted motivation to emerge from some universal principles that could be deduced by sheer reason. His advice, act only according to the maxim by which you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law, shows that Kant was unable to say much about the universal principles he referred to. This leaves John Locke, whose emphasis on rights is currently being increasingly embraced by a very large number of people. It simply means that society has definitely moved from collectivism to a collection of autonomous, self-centered individuals. Even as the clamor for rights is eclipsing the sense of responsibility, that this is not exactly a recent trend is evident from Kennedy's famous exhortation in his inaugural address as the President of USA. Way back in 1963, Kennedy famously said, "Ask not what America can give you, but ask instead what you can give to America." Every year at the time of the Institute convocation, Swami gave similar advice to the outgoing graduates, but at a much higher level, by calling upon students to serve society, meaning humanity, instead of expecting society to do things for them. Have we arrived at an answer for the question, where does our sense of duty come from? No, not yet. All we have seen is that where the Mahabharata is concerned, its characters did accept duty and in some loose way also believed that duty had a moral foundation that had some relationship to the divine. Where the Western world is concerned, a strong sense of duty did prevail until, say, even the early part of the 20th century, rooted in Christian values as far as the ordinary people were concerned. But in the case of intelligentsia, the sense of duty began to change, influenced as they were by other considerations. Presently, the entire outlook has been turned upside down, with rights dominating the scene rather than a sense of responsibility. Sadly, despite having the United Nations and whatnot, when it comes to sticky issues like climate change, for example, countries behave very much like individuals with much selfishness and self-interest. That's all fine, but where does it leave Das and we who are tracking him? As for Das, at the end of the third chapter, he is still not happy about the picture of Dharma he has from the Mahabharata. And he seems to lean instead towards what he refers to as the clean ethical theory of utilitarianism, which attempts to resolve the moral issue on the basis of a single criterion. On paper, reducing decision-making to a single issue is great, as opposed to weighing the relative merits of multiple options. However, the final outcome depends on what I would call the structure of the decision-making system and what the criterion for making the decision is. In brief, it all boils down to something like this. Although the characters of the Mahabharata are not able to spell out what precisely Dharma means, they have their own gut feeling about it and do their best to follow that gut instinct. For Yudhishthira, duty always trumped everything else, which upsets Draupadi, who feels that following Dharma must yield results. At the least, Dharma must not throw its followers under the bus, as it often seemed to. Vidura always looked to the consequences of action while deciding whether an action is desirable or not. Although opinions and attitudes vary, all characters did believe in God, and to that extent I believe that for them Dharma was absolute and not relative, although they might not have been adept in interpreting Dharma. Das has a serious difficulty with this absolute standards of morality. Explaining his view, Das says, "The ethic of absolute standards and perfection appeals more to those who are far removed from public office, like Yudhishthira was when he was in the forest. The point is non-trivial and in fact has great merit. I mean, it's all nice to talk about non-violence, but history showed that much violence was needed for dealing with Hitler. In the post-war world, mercifully, the eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation between the US and the Soviet Union remained a cold war and did not slip into a hot war. Thank God it did not, for with each side having over 30,000 nuclear weapons, far deadlier than those that wiped out in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, humanity could barely have survived a third world war fought with nuclear weapons." Having said that, there is a genuine question. Maybe it is true that violence becomes inevitable beyond a point. However, does that mean that even if one was really serious about non-violence right from the beginning, can dangerous endpoints never be avoided? My personal belief is that they can be. However, there is no time to go into the arguments presently. Of course, I cannot leave that important point hanging, and I do promise to come back. For now, let me stay with the topic that I am dealing with presently. I just pointed out that it is my belief that all characters in the Mahabharata were aware that there was a divinity and Dharma was in some way connected to the divine. What about Western philosophers? Why does Das visit their ideas and writings? The answer is clear from the fact that according to Das, moral values derived from absolute standards would fail in the real world. In truth, Das does have a point. Nevertheless, Das himself quotes a particular incident from Fyodor Dostoevsky's famous book, Brothers Karamazov. Das quotes a question posed by one of the characters named Ivan to his brother, Alyosha. Basically, Ivan wants a little child tortured in order to bring unimaginable happiness to humanity. Ivan challenges his brother as follows, and I quote, "Tell me honestly, I challenge you, answer me. Imagine that you are charged with building the edifice of human destiny, the ultimate end of which is to bring people happiness, to give them peace and contentment at last, but that in order to achieve this, it is essential and unavoidable to torture just one little speck of creation, that same child beating her chest with little fists, and imagine that this edifice has to be erected on her unexpected tears. Would you agree to be the architect under those conditions? Tell me honestly." Das says, Alyosha, his brother, does not have an answer, and Dostoevsky seems to feel that such questions are unsolvable. The point of this example is that the idea that an action is desirable if it leads to good consequences is put to a severe test in the example cited above. In India, such a situation would perhaps be described as a dharma sankatam or a moral dilemma. Alyosha faced one, and he had no answer. Question can be asked, okay, Alyosha had no answer to the challenge posed to him, that's understandable, but what about Dharma? Does Dharma have an answer for that question? I believe it does. And before telling you what it is, I have to first remind you that in the Mahabharata, there comes a point when Arjuna is placed in a Dharma Sankatam and does not know what to do. Left in a quandary, Arjuna submits to Krishna and seeks guidance. That is when Krishna, Lord come in human form, does what he had incarnated for, namely to give humanity an eternal message. Arjuna was just a proxy for delivering that message, and the occasion had been carefully orchestrated. So you see, once more I have worked my way to the Bhagavad Gita. To me, that is inevitable since Gita is the Gangotri of Dharma. I must mention that Krishna unravels Dharma far too tersely for us humans of the Kali age. But then Krishna, reappearing as Swami, has come to a rescue, and via innumerable discourses and of course his Vahinis, Swami has explained the subtle nuances of Dharma far more clearly than has been done before. Sadly, few seem to be even aware of what a monumental help Swami has extended to us. Okay, in that case, let us go back to the challenge that was thrown to Alyosha and Brothers Karamazov. Does Gita have an answer for Alyosha? I believe so. Well, in that case, what is Gita's answer to Alyosha? To know that, you have to tune into my next talk. I am sorry about pulling that fast one, but then there is a thing called time constraint. The clock is telling me to wind up, and I have no option but to bow to time. I apologize for ending abruptly, but I do hope that in the course of this talk, I have clarified at least some of the issues relating to Dharma. Commenting on a complex philosophical problem faced by physics in the 1930s, Einstein said, "Subtle is the Lord, but malicious he is not." Taking a cue from the great master, allow me to say, subtle sure is Dharma, but it does hold out answers, provided one looks carefully using the lens of buddhi. I think I have said enough for this talk, and let me stop here, hoping that this talk was of some use to you. Goodbye for now, and all the best. Offering this talk to Swami, I now go off the air. God bless, and Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, that brings to an end the 9th talk in the current series on Dharma presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Dear listener, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you and Sai Ram.
Happy, 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 be happy. Happy, happy, make others happy. All will be happy, God will be happy.
Love is His message, love is His form, and love is timeless, celebrating an epochal moment in an endless epic. 90 years of Satya Sai.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Hum sab milkar mangal gaaye. सब मिलकर मंगल साई भगवान सत्य साई भगवान साई भगवान सत्य साई भगवान सब सुख जीवन साई भगवान सब सुख जीवन साई भगवान सब दुख हरना साई भगवान दुख हरना साई भगवान सत्य स्वरूप साई भगवान
सत्य स्वरूप
सत्य स्वरूप साई साई भगवान करते निवासी साई भगवान हम सब मिलकर मंगल गाए साई भगवान सत्य साई भगवान साई भगवान सत्य साई भगवान सब सुख जीवन साई भगवान
सब सुख जीवन साई भगवान
कर मंगल